Hello, this is The Book Show on Apollo Bay Radio. My name's Brian Dwyer. With me, Deb Bradfield. Hello, Deb.
Hey, Brian.
And Megan Harrison. How are you, Megan?
I'm good. How are you?
After your big day,
big
Literacy
day.
Week at school.
Yes.
And what fun that is. What have you been reading, Deb?
Well, I've just come back from Bali, and the aim was to just read books, really, and not do much.
Yes.
So I headed for the bookshop in Bali and got the biggest, fattest book I could find, which was 950 pages. It was called Sacred Games by Vikram Chandra. And I've been sort of, you know, in love with India ever since I went there in the 70s. So this suited me down to the ground because it was all about India, about Mumbai. And there were two main characters. There was a Sikh policeman, and there was a crime boss. So it was a sort of an epic thriller crime novel, which had just about everything you can imagine in it with 950 pages. And you know, I couldn't put it down, really. Well, actually, it was hard to pick up in the first place, but once I got it picked up, I couldn't put it down. So it was...
Was it pulp fiction?
Well, look, it was quite violent, it was very well written, but in a really melodramatic way, which actually I thought was perfect because I find India's just melodrama
like
after melodrama. So I think he actually did that on purpose. You know, I don't think it was by accident that it was so melodramatic. And so it alternated between the story of how this crime boss actually came to be a crime boss and various cases that the Sikh policeman was investigating, which turned out to also be investigating the crime boss. The crime boss had actually died at the very beginning of the novel, and he started to tell his story just before he died to the Sikh policeman, and we then followed that story through intermittently, sort of we'd have one chapter on the policeman pursuing various
leads.
Thank you, Megan. I was groping around for the word there. And then we'd go to Gaetond, who was the crime boss. The other interesting thing about it was there was a lot of Hindi in it, so, and with no explanation. Although I found later that when I was reading some critiques on it, that some of the publications had a glossary at the back, but this one didn't. But it didn't seem to matter. You sort of the words came up so often that you ended up actually knowing them. So I think I know quite a few swear words in Hindi now. That is cemented into my brain.
English novelists do that with French phrases, don't they?
Yeah, they do.
And to be honest, I'm often annoyed because I don't know what the French means.
I think the British swear were the best, though. I think they should just stick with their own swear words.
Yes. Although Mehad's fairly good. But,
this was a book to read by the pool.
Not that I was by a pool, but it was certainly a book to read on holiday that you could immerse yourself in, and so that's what I did. Mm. And the other really interesting thing about it was, if you've spent any time in India, you'd know that corruption is just part of society. It's just through absolutely everything. And it was really interesting the way the police operated, because they didn't get much money from the government. So everything came really from their bribes and their, you know, their dealings. And a lot of that money, it went to the person that was taking the bribe, but it also filtered up rather than down. Didn't filter down much, but it did go back up.
The trickle up.
Yes. And it was also used, in fact, to get extra information from other people about other crimes. And so it was used, a lot of the bribes were actually used in the policing work. So I thought that was interesting. So, yeah, it's just, there's just so much corruption in India. I don't think you'd ever get rid of it. But I don't know that the place would function without it, really.
So, Deb, I'll get you to jot down the name of that book,
yes,
so that I can put that on the podcast.
Yeah. So it was Sacred Games, mm-hmm, by Vikram Chandra, and I'll
excellent
write that down.
Well,
for
if
a minute.
I'm ever in Bali for 2 weeks with not much to do, I'll possibly read that book.
Yeah, no, I think it's. I don't think you need to go to Bali to read it, but you do have to be interested in all things Indian, which I am, so that's why it particularly interested me.
I'll come back to your other book. Megan, what about you?
I picked up a graphic novel this week after reading your Tony Jordan, which you reviewed last time.
Yes.
I quickly read through that and thought I'd read something completely different, so I got a secondhand graphic novel when I was away in Bendigo. And I really do enjoy them, but I often find they are expensive. But it's almost like buying an art book. They have to be printed so nicely with their artwork.
Really? Yeah.
This was very autobiographical, about a Japanese man living within American society, dropped out of uni, not quite sure what he's going to do with his life, not quite angst, but didn't really want to face up to his own problems, I suppose, with his relationship, and he having that ideal of having the white, attractive female partner as well, and then being almost a traitor to his parents, and lots of sort of cultural ideas came up in it. But yeah, I quite enjoyed that. That was Shortcomings by Adrian Tomeen.
But yes. It looks like I hadn't seen those before. It looks like a sort of a comic in book form.
Yes, graphic novel.
Ah,
yeah.
Never heard of it.
It's a bit more than a comic book, so it's like, yeah, because I imagine most comic books really are printed just for pulp, kind of like very mass produced, whereas these are almost put, like, this is Faber and Faber published, which is one of my favorite publishers,
right?
And the illustrator is a different person.
Not in this case. Sometimes they are, but no, in this case he's done the words and the drawings.
Well, I think he might possibly have spent more time on the artwork than the words.
Possibly, yes. But the pictures do tell a story, and not as, like, there's often, I have a few other graphic novels at home with a lot less text in them than these, and they let the image tell the entire story.
Yes.
But this case, he's actually got quite a bit of text.
But that's a massive amount of work for an illustrator.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Gosh, you'd want to sell a lot of books to...
Yes, and they're not...
Well, that's why they're expensive.
Yes. And I think they're quite difficult to get published as well.
Yes. Right. What size would you say that is, Megan? It's sort of...
Well, yeah, it's only 100 pages, really. 108 pages.
Yeah, and it's not quite an A4.
No, it's just
format,
a tiny bit larger than A5.
But it's bigger, it's bigger than your average book in... area.
Yes.
I think we've gone from one extreme to the other here, because you've got some very little text and I got 950 pages.
You had the brick.
And just to go back a fortnight, did you enjoy Our Tiny Useless Hearts?
That's not true. I wasn't going to say I didn't enjoy it. I did enjoy elements of it, but I kept, as I was reading it, kept thinking about Lee saying, why are they there? Why doesn't he just go? And I started getting frustrated with the same characters, like, why are you still there?
It's a bedroom farce, it just gets sillier and sillier.
Oh, does it? Yeah, I remember you talking about it. That was the one set in Melbourne, wasn't it? Well, outside in one of the suburbs.
Yeah, I think it's very much Eltham. Yes. It was just, I didn't understand... I saw all of the characters around the main narrator funny, but the narrator herself, I didn't find much humour in her. I suppose I needed a bit more in her to make it funny out loud. But yeah, it was good. It was an easy read.
Now, Deb, how are you going with Lawrence M. Krauss?
Yes, well, actually, one of the reasons I got the 950-page Indian book was because I had taken A Universe from Nothing with me to read, and I knew it was going to be hard going, and I thought, I'll just put it off for a few days, got the 950-pager, but did come back, and I'm halfway through this now. So this is, it's called A Universe from Nothing, and it's supposed to be... informing us as to how the Big Bang, I suppose, really, how there was nothing and now we've got this giant expanding universe and how that happened. Well, I don't know yet. I'm halfway through and I haven't found out how that happened. there have been a couple of bits in it that I've found really fascinating, and that was the fact that the universe, any galaxy that like is two times further away from us than another galaxy is going away from us at two times the speed of the one that's near us. And he does a fantastic illustration of that in this book, and I actually understood that, so that was great. But there's a lot I haven't understood. I'm really grappling with it, like, you know, dark matter and dark energy. And
well, and I wonder if you'd be interested to know that the person who discovered the expanding universe was a woman who was working as a technician, because being a woman, she wasn't allowed to make the observations.
Yeah, she gets a mention. She gets a mention in here, and actually I wrote her name down.
Henrietta Leavitt.
That's right. Mm. Yes. Yeah, so...
1912.
Yeah, amazing that we've known that for so long, really.
Yes.
Look, it's... all of these science books that is, you know, written for the lay person, I still think they're really hard to understand, even though I used to be a science teacher, but I struggle with this. But I'm determined to keep going. So a universe from nothing, hopefully in a couple of weeks I will be able to tell you
how you finished it.
Yes, and how the universe came from nothing at all. Zero, zilch, and now we've got this, you know, massive expanding
universe. We're coming back
to
science very shortly, but I just have to tell you about one of my favourites, Janet Ivanovich, who's written, I think, 16 books in the Stephanie Plum series. Stephanie Plum is a New Jersey bounty hunter. And at the start of every chapter, you get a description of what she's wearing for the day.
Oh, well, I'd like that.
And, you know, the girls in the office are sort of former hookers and, you know, and they all like to come along for the ride on the bounty hunts, you know, and it's hilarious. And she's kind of in love with two quite contrasting men. One's a law enforcement agent, the other one has a more dark activities.
Okay, is that a library book there, Brian?
It would be in the library. Yes, it is a library book. Janet Ivanovich. It's very funny.
Yeah, good.
It's what the equivalent of a Friday night movie, if you know what I mean. It's very light and very funny, and her grandma always wants to come along and arrest somebody. You know. And her mother always wants to know when she's going to meet a nice boy and get married, you know. It's very funny. This one's called Three Get Deadly, so you won't be astonished to know. The first in the series is called One to Get Ready. Oh, no, what's it called? One for the Money.
Oh,
two for the show. Yeah, three to get ready, and yeah, whatever. And it goes up to 16. So,
she made up a few there. So there's after that, then.
There's that one, and like yourself, Deb, I needed a little bit of relief after all the heavy stuff I've been reading.
Yes,
and I've just got another one, Megan, which you know is fairly heavy. Hannah Kent. This is a first novel.
Oh, yes. That's great. I read that one.
Have you? Burial Rites. It certainly looks pretty interesting. It's about the imminent execution of a woman in Iceland in 1829.
Yeah, the last woman executed in Iceland.
Oh, right. Mm. Yes. So it's looks like a very interesting read.
Yeah, it is. I really enjoyed that. I read that probably a year ago.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a good one.
The landscape and the climate, like the geography becomes a personality in the story, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Looking forward to that. All right. Thank you so much, Deb Bradfield, Megan Harrison.
Very nice to be with you.
We'll be back very shortly with our science book show.
Yeah, I'll be glued.
On the book show from Apollo Bay Radio, my name's Brian. With me, Liz Cameron. How are you, Liz?
I'm very well, Brian.
And Dennis Sharples. G'day, Dennis.
Hi, Brian. How you doing?
We'd like to introduce Liz to our listeners. How long have you been in Apollo Bay, Liz?
About 14 weeks now, Brian, and it's been a deal of pleasure.
Yeah. And you have a background in education?
That's right. I have taught in secondary schools for about 20 years. That was a lot of that was alternative schools. And in the last 10 or 15 years of my life, has actually been working in the vet sector, and probably in workplaces, really, but still with a strong sense of science and background to its application.
So you have that in common with Dennis Sharples. You've both been science teachers at some stage of your lives.
How exciting.
Dennis, I enjoyed your talk with John Smith a couple of weeks ago. What are you reading?
At the moment.
Well, anything scientific?
Oh, well, it's interesting. I just finished a book called Never Let Me Go, which I suppose is more science fiction than scientific. The author is Japanese. I can't remember his name. I'll have to look on my phone. But basically it's using clones, or there's these clones who have been manufactured and are alive, and they're used for transplants, and it's sort of investigating various issues in society by looking at the lives of these clones in Britain. Yes.
As all good science fiction does, it looks at social issues.
Well, this was very social issues and not so much science fiction, because he doesn't talk about where the clones came from or anything like that, or even how the clones are used. So it's mostly looking at social issues, but it was one of the most morbidly horrifying books I've ever read.
What was that called?
Never Let Me Go.
Yes.
It's been a film.
Now, you did confide in me recently that you've read a book called Deadly Companions.
Yes, I did. I have it here with me.
And I was reminded of that when I read in The Age this morning advice to the effect that you should not make your bed in the morning. And the reason why you should not make your bed, some of us never do anyway, is because if you air the bed, the microbes will die. But if you keep the bed nice and warm, the microbes will flourish.
That's right, Brian. I've been not making my bed for years.
And there's a scientific basis for it. Microbes. Now, I happen to know that, and I could find the date for you, that microbes were discovered by a very clever person. When was that about?
Louis.
Even before that, 1665, Hooke.
Oh, Hooke, yes.
Discovered microorganisms, and that's 300 years before Louis Pasteur.
Was that the first thing with his microscope?
Yeah.
He wasn't actually looking at
No.
The first thing he looked at, we can't talk about, can we?
Oh, yes, we can.
Yes,
can we?
Go
ahead. Well, he was looking at some sperm. We won't say where it came from, but he got a fresh sample, and he was stunned by what he saw.
Yes.
All these small things wriggling around. But I don't know whether he got onto germ theory, and you can't see microbes with a light microscope.
No.
You can see a protozoa.
It's an interesting aspect of science that sometimes people make a discovery, the implications of which are not obvious for quite some time.
Absolutely true.
For instance, the telescope was well in use before Galileo applied it to the heavens. So that book, just remind me the title, Deadly Companions.
Yeah. It's written by an English microbiologist called Dorothy Crawford, and basically what she does is sets the scene by saying microbes predate us on Earth by about 3.5 billion years, and they're very highly evolved. There's trillions of different sorts, and we've got no hope of ever describing them all. Every organism on Earth has microbes that are evolved to live with it. Sometimes it's companion living where one benefits the other, and other times it's infection.
Right.
And
we've got creepy crawlies all over our bodies, haven't we? Yes.
There's more microbes on your body than there are cells, but bacteria are far, far smaller than human cells, so that's not really that big a stat. But, yeah, there are lots, and most of us live symbiotically with this, meaning that they do us good.
Yes.
Interesting that we've spent a lot of years actually trying to sort of wash our hands so that we don't have any of those things on us or elsewhere in the on our bodies, isn't it? And we've got to the stage where you wonder how much of what's going on at the moment is partly because we have attacked those microbes without being very distinctive in what we were looking at.
Well, most harmful microbes, which is sort of broadly called pathogens, are actually microbes that have evolved to be somewhere else and get into us by mistake. Right. So, for instance, TB, which nobody gets anymore, used to grow in grass and still does. And if it can manage to get into your body, into a part of it where there's not much oxygen around, it can kill you quite quickly by producing one of the most lethal toxins known.
But in its natural state, it's benign.
Yeah, well, it lives in grass and stews grass up and has fun doing it.
Is that a recent book? Deadly companions?
I did look. I bought it in La Trobe, I suppose, about 10 years ago. But unlike some of the astronomy ones, which are requiring a bit of knowledge of physics for you to get your head around it, this one's very readable. Mm. And did the rounds of my friends after I got it. And looks, as I said, at how microbes have basically shaped our history and how we shape the microbes also, that prey on us, if you will. So something like measles, for instance, that everybody's familiar with, seems to have first arisen from a cattle virus around about 5,000 years ago when humans first started domesticating cattle. And it's been with us ever since in various strains and things like that. And, of course, measles is a very infectious and quite serious disease.
Are there new diseases? Like in the 1980s, everyone heard of AIDS and HIV, and that was that actually a new disease, or what? How did that?
Relatively new. Yes. That's covered in this book. I'd sort of read a little bit of it before I came. They think that was a virus that was originally endemic to monkeys in Africa, and probably skipped to humans because there was African customs where I think this is right. Some Africans would eat live brain of monkeys as part of their sort of bushmeat ceremonies and stuff like that. So they think that skipped around about 1940, but of course didn't sort of hit the headlines until it got to New York, probably via a male air hostess, and became a terribly serious problem in the 1980s.
Yes. And there's... are there strains of flu and those kinds of things? Are they new?
Mutate periodically. Probably a good one to look at is Ebola, which also arose in Africa, which is a very, very, very infectious disease. But to catch Ebola, you actually have to contact body fluids of the person who's infected, which is blood or sputum or vomit or something like that, which means although if you get Ebola, it will quite likely kill you, Ebola doesn't spread very well because... it can't get up into the air and move around and things like that. You don't cough it out and that type of thing. But things like those very infectious diseases skip into humans from other species. But having said that, once they do, they quickly become less virulent. And smallpox is another excellent example of that. Smallpox has been killing humans more regularly than anything else, even other humans. For thousands and thousands of years, it's now eradicated. There's only a sample held in Russia and the United States, just in case somebody starts germ warfare again. But when smallpox reaches a community, it kills a lot of people, but gradually loses virulence as the less infectious strains of smallpox take over. The more virulent ones kind of kill everybody they infect before they can multiply very much, and so over time it's the less infectious strain that will sort of dominate, and then it will persist in a population.
Are there any which diseases remain threatening now?
Well, smallpox would be awfully threatening if we hadn't eradicated it. So there was it's the first microbe we've successfully killed. And so I think in the 70s, maybe earlier, the WHO decided they were going to eradicate the world from smallpox. And in a wonderful example of how people can actually work together, they chased smallpox around the world, vaccinating people, until the last case of smallpox, I think, was reported in the early 70s. And so this disease, which has disfigured and killed countless billions of people, is now held in a jar in Moscow and I think somewhere in America, I'm not sure where, in the US somewhere. So it's gone.
Fabulous story.
Well, hopefully it's gone.
Well, hopefully, yes.
And would I be right in thinking that Louis Pasteur was the person who introduced vaccination?
Vaccination was, as you said, quite a long story. It was, I think the first vaccination was done by a man called Jenner.
Right.
And that was, I think, I'm just shooting from the hip here, but I think that was to do with smallpox as well. And what he did was he'd noticed that milkmaids who caught cowpox off the cows they were milking didn't seem to get smallpox when smallpox came through.
Uh-huh.
And so in an act that would get him struck off in modern medical research, he deliberately infected a boy. No, first he infected the boy with cowpox, and then he deliberately infected the boy with smallpox, which would have been a bit of a problem if his idea wasn't right for the boy.
Mm.
But, of course, the boy didn't get sick.
Yeah.
And so that was the first instance of vaccination in the world.
That raises a very interesting question about ethics in medical research, doesn't it? Which we might come back to.
That's all right. Just get a small boy if you want to sort of test something out. I used to do it all the time.
At some stage. Liz, what have you been reading?
Well, I took your advice and have been reading Towards the Light by A.C. Grayling, which, as it mentions here, is the story of the struggles for liberty and rights that made the modern West. Very interesting book and a good context for the notions of sort of science that we have been discussing.
Yes, he tries to trace how the scientific age or scientific method emerged from the Middle Ages, and I just found it really interesting that he associates it with the social, political and religious struggles for freedom of thought, and he's arguing that those other struggles are precursors or necessary conditions for the emergence of science.
It struck me that it was a very strong book for about 8 of its 10 chapters, the last two chapters where he sort of more or less does the 19th and 20th century, a sort of a rushed way of having a look at where we're at. And in some ways, I think he sort of would probably in retrospect go back and sort of say, well, what I was arguing about the 16th century, that we actually overcame that and we got personal freedoms, for instance, are at threat again, and probably a fairly good point. I think his, as you say, his argument also that personal freedom enabled people to sort of say, well, what do I think? And perhaps a little bit, as we were talking earlier, the sleepwalking opportunity, the sort of stuff Brian's been talking about, serendipity moments, which enable people to see things a bit more clearly. I love the book because of the passion he showed for sort of arguing that we are moving forward, and he's very optimistic rather than some of the more pessimistic views that you have.
Yes, Grayling's also written another book called The Age of Genius. I think it's subtitled The Birth of the Modern Mind. It's about the 17th century, and it basically goes from Galileo to Isaac Newton, or perhaps a little beyond. But he talks about Kepler and Galileo. He's a big fan of René Descartes. He makes the point that Descartes separated science from both magic, which was prevalent at the time, and from the dogma of the church. So he's a big Descartes fan. I can't say I followed everything he said about Descartes. The interesting thing about Descartes is that he wasn't an empiricist. He was, you know, as philosophers say, a rationalist, thinking you can work it all out in your head. And in contrast, since Isaac Newton, we've really developed empiricism as the model for scientific knowledge, and we distinguish that knowledge from other claims to knowledge.
It's an interesting point there was what we were talking about before with the origin of the universe and Einstein, for instance. A lot of Einstein's discoveries, like general relativity, were done empirically.
We're not,
empirically,
but because, were verified empirically.
Well, he didn't think you would be able to verify them empirically when he came up with the ideas.
Mm.
So, as you said, they were thought experiments that really had no data to back them up.
Yeah. I think another book that's, I reckon, related to that is Brighter Than a Thousand Suns, which, of course, talks about the development of the atomic bomb and very much the sort of games that scientists who were then declared as physicists, I suppose, played in sort of making up something. I mean, the whole structure of the atom has really been was an imaginative creation, still is, I suppose, in terms of most of what we test. But it is an absolutely crucial point that science relies on imagination as much as it does on empiricism, I think. But
yes, so interesting.
There's many examples of that sort of thing, really. Again, when you were talking before about a universe from nothing. The famous New Zealand scientist Ernest Rutherford, when he first did his experiments firing neutrons at a gold sheet.
In the 1930s.
Yes, he was staggered that they went straight through.
Yes.
As if nothing was there. And again, they had to sort of come up with some construction to explain why this gold sheet was so permeable. And of course, it's because atoms are mostly nothing.
Right. Yes.
Brian, you didn't know this.
I did, actually. I did. Yes. And it's I don't know if it's a conundrum, but something like, I'm just going to knock on the table, seems to be fairly solid structure, but it's what proportion of that would be nothing, like 90%?
Oh, well, the standard high school one is, if you imagine the Apollo Bay football ground with a football in the middle, that's far bigger than the atomic nucleus.
And the fly, really?
fly zooming around the outside is way bigger than an electron. So all the rest of it is just nothing, which just is why Rutherford's neutrons pass so aimlessly through.
Yes.
But as you were talking about before, when a neutron does hit the middle, you can get an atomic explosion.
Yes.
If you've got the right atom.
Now, I have two scientists in front of me. Three, Deb, counting you in the background.
Jump on, Deb.
Now, what? Something I kind of learnt, I won't say I actually know this very well, but that there are four forces in the universe. There's gravity. There's electromagnetism, there's nuclear stability, and there's nuclear decay.
Strong and weak nuclear.
Yeah. The four forces. Now, there are some mysterious things happening, you know, in quantum physics about how things behave and how those forces behave, which, dare I say, scientists don't actually understand. Do they?
The thought experiments.
Yes.
Well, they understand them well enough to use them in the everyday world, like everybody understands gravity very well. I mean, that was the idea of Einstein's work, and Einstein was horrified that he couldn't unify all those forces before he died, and was supposed to be working on it the night he did die. Gravity is too weak compared to all the others, and that seems to have something to do with expanding space and the origin of the universe and all those sorts of things. And I'm sure by the time I die, everybody will know all about it. And of course, the other two are locked up inside the atom.
Yes. But
they're all field forces, which means they act over a distance.
And I think for listeners, I mean, it does seem to be very important to be able to define the difference between sort of the classical science that we actually associate with Newton and the sort of mechanical existence, which we now accept as being an approximation or works in certain circumstances. And as a physics teacher, I was always sort of interested in how you actually looked at some of the laws that existed, in the sense that they work dependent on the environment that they're actually in. So the real result of Einstein, as I would sort of say, was to sort of suggest that as we get down close to the level of the life of an atom, we have to change our rules, or otherwise nothing works in the way that, they did for Newton. Newton, yes, obviously started the Industrial Revolution in effect by, yes, mechanising the world. Einstein has obviously given us another look at God's face, I think, really, hasn't it? And we're going to work for you know, another century to try and sort of actually define what exactly is going on in some of these things. And so items like string theory that I'm sure the average person has probably heard of but has no idea of how that then gets interpreted in terms of space-time or dark matter or black holes or something. The sort of things that it feels to me as though there is a pathway to that, and some of that is caught up in these books, isn't it? As you describe what Newton was going through, you do know that he's also Chancellor of the Exchequer. You do know that he's actually going through the period of the plague. You do know that there are sort of things that are actually shaping why he does what he does. That's what makes science exciting for most of us who have been scientists, is that you see that this is not logical and as streamlined as you might hope. It's something where you've got to draw ideas from all over the place.
Yes, what an interesting point. I'll come back and ask you something about the impact of science on our lives. Science has had a fantastic impact on our lives. So just, Liz, I don't know what is taught in high school science, but let's just go back to 1610 when Galileo published his observations of the moons of Jupiter, building, of course, on the work of Copernicus, you know, who realised that the Earth was moving. And then as we mentioned before, Hooke's microscope, also in the 17th century. Ole Romer calculated the speed of light in 1776. Yeah. That's quite amazing. And on that point, Eratosthenes calculated the circumference of the Earth, and he died in 194 BC. Mm. So there have been some fabulous things happening, which the average layperson like myself is perhaps not aware of. Now, Grayling's point is that a lot of these scientific discoveries have been associated with social change. For instance, the Enlightenment, you know, which kind of followed all this wonderful stuff in the 1600s. In 1735, witchcraft was decriminalised. So one of the characteristics of this new scientific age was that some of the old medieval magic stuff had lost or was losing credibility. That's an interesting impact that science has had. Some of the faith-based belief has lost credibility, and when you get up to, you know, the end of the 19th century, you know, Darwin has challenged a lot of faith-based claims to knowledge. There's a lot of social changes have accompanied the scientific changes, and sometimes one has caused the other, and sometimes it's been the other way around.
Certainly seems to me that Grayling does make a very strong point of that, about the fact that the Catholic Church overreached, that in some levels the fact that Catholicism had sort of dominated the whole of Europe had given a unity to at least Europe that didn't exist and doesn't exist at the moment, as we've just seen. What it did do was a sort of that notion of a common philosophy. The trouble is that philosophy was obviously starting to break apart as they had to deal with Islam and probably Judaism, especially in Spain. Yes. And obviously, the revitalizing the Inquisition, which basically had never been anything like as badly in the 15th century. 16th century, obviously meant that people were starting to doubt whether or not the church knew what it was doing anyway. Then you came along with three people, as you previously said, who were all Catholics and passionate Catholics, but they were exposing the fact that we didn't have an earth-centered solar system or universe, and so therefore what the hell was going on? And so Grayling would argue that was the birth of a rational human being rather than a faith-based person, I think.
Yes, Yes.
We like to see those sorts of things of having existed in the past, but I think we're going through exactly the same thing now. Where, yes. If you look at someone like, was Galileo that was under house arrest, wasn't he?
Yes.
For saying that the Earth wasn't the centre of the solar system. Everybody knew that. He was just the person who said it.
Yes.
At the moment, it's not exactly parallel, but you've got much the same things with climate change going on. Like, everybody knows climate change is true, but people in power, people running economies, don't want to see it that way because of the amount of change and dislocation that's going to cause, which seems absurd when you're looking at it because it's going to proceed whether we sort of deal with it or not. And it was a bit the same when Galileo or Darwin published.
Yes.
It was the tsunami that was going to get you. It was true. You had to think about things in a different way. It was just a matter of moving from one spot to the other. But the powers that be didn't particularly like it then, and they don't really like it now.
And my friend Maureen McFadgen makes this point about that Copernicus published in 1543, but he wasn't banned until 1616. Mm. So the Catholic community were quite prepared to discuss all these things, and to a certain extent her point is that as long as you could discuss it amongst yourselves or amongst the well-educated classes, what they didn't want was they didn't want the peasants to get ideas above their station, so they didn't want to disseminate the knowledge. They didn't mind what Galileo thought, as long as he didn't say it outside of, you know, those closed confines. And I think that one of the great things science has done, actually, is it's broken down that hegemony where, you know, everybody now has access to knowledge.
Yeah, I'm not sure that we could point science at that. I mean, I think that's, again, Grayling will make the point that the political changes of the 17th and 18th century are the ones that have obviously given us access to information in a broader way. I'm not sure that, Brian's thoughts may be that, you know, about a scientific culture, it does feel to me as though a lot of us have got lost by the science that we have. I mean, we're all victims of a sort of a news cycle that dazzles us. I think it's probably true about science that, you know, if you happen to be a biologist, you're probably not a physicist. If that's the case, you, like Deb was suggesting, you feel confident about the area that you perhaps have known. But even now, I mean, I know that my physics training finished in 1968. Now, there's been so much done in the world of quantum mechanics that it almost makes that redundant. There's no formal sort of training for this, so we're all in a position where we lack sizable doses, especially of the actual ability to measure. We can hear rumours. I mean, I know so many kids who would not have the slightest proof in their head that the Earth is actually spinning. Yeah. They accept the fact that science is. So we're really in an age of sort of, again, which we're asking, have faith in your science teachers who will tell you what the truth is, rather than here's the evidence for that. Now, that's probably poor science teaching that produces that, but a lot of people finish.
But that's so true. I mean, I couldn't prove to you, you know, that the Earth orbits the sun.
That's right. And if you can't, then you obviously you're gullible at this point. And you can know it. And I mean, I'd be interested in Brian sort of exploring that a little bit more too, because it does feel to me as though the evidence that we have is not always sort of valuable in the sense that it doesn't give us a chance to go out and put it back into practice ourselves.
You can prove the Earth orbits the sun if you get up early, Brian. It comes up, you can see it.
Yes.
And goes across the sky, then goes down on the other side.
Well, actually, I think I can, because who's the Frenchman who created the pendulum? Foucault's pendulum, yes.
Well, he was just pointing out what everybody else knew. It was a very clever experiment that, as you sort of say, does provide proof. It's like if you're teaching people about tides, so when a tide comes in, it's not actually the water moving, it's the Earth. It's just requiring you to think about it in a different way. But, I mean, those concepts aren't difficult, and you can sort of slop a bowl around to prove it. But that's just the way it is, and it needs to be discussed more, as you sort of said. For a society that relies so heavily on science, we don't sort of talk about it very much.
No, but there's another thing that's happening too, and in the political field this has been quite obvious recently, that there are whole parts of human activity in the 21st century which are kind of anti-rational, where people just don't accept climate the change. Evidence. Yep. They just don't accept it. And you could even go further and say there are certain political candidates who just don't even bother to distinguish between fact and fiction.
Well, they play to fear. Like vaccination, since I was talking about the microbe book before, is an excellent example where you have quite well-educated people who won't get their children vaccinated basically because their children don't die of these horrible diseases anymore that aren't that far away. One of the most interesting things I saw done at the school while I was there was... I think it was a data collection activity where they looked at people who were in the Apollo Bay Cemetery. And up until about the 1930s, you know, there's people popping off from pneumonia and all these other sort of totally preventable diseases now. And by far the thing that sort of stopped people being killed by microbes is vaccination. And it's just astounding that people could be so frightened of something that's been so successful.
This is one of the great things about social media, isn't it, which we would argue is a triumph of science, but that it actually enables some idiot to actually give us information that is absolutely as wrong as that. But, I mean, again, we are still... I mean, I'd be interested to know how many people feel as though they can validate what they're actually even reading, isn't it? I mean, how do I actually...
So, like, if I said I'm not having my child vaccinated and you would say, why, like, what's their answer?
Well, I mean, they do have one, and that is because they've got evidence from some person who's saying, I had my child vaccinated and they died. Or you know, here's an example, isn't it? So the evidence and the authority. Mm. I mean, I was thinking that
I don't think that's evidence, though. I think it's just rumour.
Well, I agree with you. It's not adequate evidence, is it? Not reproducible. But and that's what you were saying earlier, Brian, I think, isn't it, that we believe that we established a scientific method in 1600s, which was irrefutable, and yet very few people use it. Yes. Where most of us are getting better at using clear thinking techniques, it seemed to me, even that one ain't that obvious, is it? But I think very few people would come out of 10 years of schooling anyway feeling as though they've actually sort of got the framework, the infrastructure to actually be able to make judgments on scientific issues. And so it's really, do I trust the scientists who are there or don't I? Yeah. And so we're going back to a sort of a faith-based notion of what guides the future of our planet.
Yes. Yeah. So there are two issues I think are interesting. One is this sort of appeal to ignorance and fear that Dennis was talking about, and there's a lot of that about. There's also still quite a strong body of faith-based belief, which is non-scientific, and I'm thinking of, you know, religions and religious movements. They're still quite strong, but they are not based on empiricism, they're based on faith. But I would like to move on to this question. Does science itself have an ideology? And you're saying that, well, we trust, to the extent that we trust our scientists, we're relying on faith. But does science itself have an ideology? Kessler raises this point in his book, The Sleepwalkers, that scientists too, like all human beings, are very fond of the way they do things, and they don't want to think about doing it differently, and they become prisoners of their own methodologies and so on. And he gives several examples, which I can't think of now, of scientists refusing to admit evidence because they're sort of so happy with, you know, their...
Well, the thalidomide scandal is a case of point where a very reputable scientist didn't use the data because it was actually going to mean that his recognition would have been
His career was over.
And that's right, isn't it? I mean, scientists are only other human beings with the same interest in making wealth for themselves and beating someone else to death for the next job opportunity or what have you.
Yeah.
I don't mean all of them, but we're in the position where we're actually struggling to make sense of a world that doesn't actually hold the individual as being worthy enough. And I mean, it does feel to me as though the ideology of science again would argue that we are dispassionate, when probably Kessler would be sort of saying, well, it's not the way it works anyway. No. You heard someone say something in a corridor and then you use that as the basis of your PhD, or as you said earlier, the woman who did the job is not given the credit, somebody else is. So we're still human beings, but it does seem to me as though one of the great things about Grayling, you know, the revolution that was going to change all revolutions in France and had perhaps the best articulation turns into the terror. What are these two things and two steps forward and one step back in so much of what we're actually doing? Yes. Science has probably got to do better at sort of engaging the whole populace, and I think the idea of community scientists that's being sort of called on by various parts of the public sector, at least, is an interesting step forward, I think.
Yes, and does the Commonwealth of Australia actually have a Department of Science in the federal government these days? I think it does.
It does again.
They've got a head scientist, a boss scientist.
Yes, and there are two aspects to that. There's the one about knowledge for its own sake, but of course, if we believe in innovation, of course we must have research.
Well, I think
we must have.
The Brighter Than a Thousand Suns was quite influential on me, as you're already hearing. But as you listen to people, I mean, it was effectively the story of a mass murder which people could have stopped if they just simply decided they weren't going to go and investigate the structure.
Which people do you think could have stopped it?
Oh, well, everyone from Oppenheimer to Truman or whatever, they could have said, we're not going to do this, aren't we?
It's a classic thing of they've created a weapon that was heavily funded by the government, and once the weapon was created, the government were going to use it. And that was the end of the story. It wasn't theirs.
Well, I think the other thing was that all of those scientists who had been part of it had that dichotomy that we all have as scientists: is I've just created something, but I don't really know what the effect is. And there's no doubt there was some of that was okay. I'm going to drop it on Hiroshima to see what happens.
Well, there were doubts if it would go off.
That's right. Yes. That's right.
Yeah. Then it did, and once it went off, I dare say it was out of the scientists' hands.
And there were doubts too that when they trialled it in New Mexico, whether or not they could actually stop the
reaction. I read something where someone worker there heard scientists taking bets on whether or not the explosion was going to incinerate the atmosphere, because they weren't sure, as you said, they could stop the chain reaction.
Now, I was just talking before about the age of reason and, you know, how we all, well, the human race collectively felt fairly pleased with itself in, say, the year 1800, and the 19th century was the great century of mechanical progress. And the Frenchman Lapace wrote about the mechanical universe in 1825, and people promulgated this notion that, God was the great designer. However, there have been quite a lot of systematic critiques of the so-called Age of Reason. For instance, Rousseau's Romanticism insisted that emotion was as important as reason. The post-colonialist philosophers and historians thought that, well, all those people who went out into the new world to create empires were thought of themselves as scientific, modern people, but they were enslaving other races, they were dispossessing indigenous people, all believing that they were behaving reasonably. And the feminists would say the same thing, that at the beginning of the 20th century, people thought that they were being very reasonable, but they wouldn't allow women to vote. And there are all of these notions about what it is to be reasonable. and
my side wins. And yeah. Bob Dylan says, you know, I've got on my side, not you haven't.
So there are a lot of ongoing debates, and there will continue to be, about you know, what constitutes reasonableness. And science is not based on reason, is it? It is.
Well, it can't extract itself from a society that it exists in, isn't it? Every scientist would like to think that they were gathering evidence and drawing conclusions from that evidence. But if you're in a world where that result then determines what your future is, you may well make changes that are not rational or not going to be in the common well. That seemed to me to be another thing that Grayling was pointing up, is that until we get a world where the common good is the essence of what we're doing, then there will always be these acts of bastardry, really.
Yes, so like reason is producing the atomic bomb. Reasonableness is how you're going to use it. Should it have reasonably been dropped on Japan? Yeah. Should it reasonably be stored as it is at the moment, where there's so many atomic bombs they could wipe out the human race in a blink? We're still doing it.
Yes.
It's an unreasonable idea to keep that many atomic bombs sitting around sort of pointed at wherever.
And, of course, given the capacity of the human race, why is there still disease and starvation in the world, really? I mean, that's...
Well, I think that sort of... the whole notion of the Gaia and the fact that we are interacting in a way that one finds very difficult to say, isn't happening. We become more and more obvious, I suppose, as we look at the influences of climate change. It would seem to me as though there is no doubt there is some sort of moral approach that has to occur that actually sort of says we are just another species on this planet, that we will be wiped away. And probably the most gripping thing that I've seen on climate change, when someone actually says, look, Mother Earth is not worried.
No.
You're just you're another accident that's happened. She will go on existing. You won't. Just understand that's what the problem with the bombs is. You might wipe out a whole lot of other species, but there will still be cockroaches and microbes and others which will go on and reform whatever and make better use of this planet perhaps than we have. But
the politics is proving more difficult than the science.
The measles virus won't be happy if we disappear. It's put all its eggs in our basket.
I'm going to finish with a philosophical question. Galileo asked famously, as so did Plato and others, why is there anything at all? Why does stuff exist? And the other great philosophical question through the ages has been, well, how are we to live? What is right and what is wrong? Now, my question to you two scientists is, are they scientific questions or are they not scientific questions?
I think they are scientific questions. Science works towards trying to answer them.
And this is where
Grayling,
Krauss, Deb taken the book A Universe from Nothing. She's taken
she did.
It.
She took it with her. She's going to read the rest of it tonight.
Lawrence Krauss, and he would argue, Dennis, that yes, it's scientific. Richard Dawkins would argue, yes, that's a scientific question.
It's why like scientific questions. It's a whole thing. It's just a method of inquiry. It's not some sort of body of learning or things like that. It produces, if you will, facts as it goes along, but it is a way of looking at things rather than a body of knowledge.
It is interesting to me that I think Sartre, who also wrote a book called The Age of Reason, did look at that notion from the existentialist point of view. It is because it is, and I'm satisfied enough with that at the moment. I'm happy to be investigating our deep past and our imminent future, but I don't think it matters to me very much about whether we exist at all and whether it does exist. I think that's a question for 14 or 15 year olds to ponder for a little while and then move on. It does interest me that there does seem to me to be a purpose in a rational argument within some sort of moral code. And one of the things that I'm still going to be supportive a little bit of religions existing, at least, is that we should be looking for that. And I think at one point when we were looking into the cosmos with complete awe and not such an aggressive sense that we will understand one day there was a greater sense of the fact that perhaps we have to make peace with this. And so I'm very strong on the notion that we could do a whole lot better as human beings by listening to our past a little bit better and perhaps returning to that age of innocence that that probably did characterise those first looks into the cosmos. You know.
And if people find that they're responding to what you just said, Les, we would recommend Arthur Koestler's The Sleepwalkers.
We would.
And we'll be back to go through our titles after this. Some of the titles which we could recommend to you, Les and Dennis, I'll start. Grayling's two books, Towards the Light by A.C. Grayling, is a history of the struggle for intellectual freedom. His other book is The Age of Genius, the 17th Century and the Birth of the Modern Mind. There are a couple of chapters which are heavy going. I mean, I'm not sure the 30 Years' War is of, you know, all that interesting to your average reader, but I do recommend it nevertheless, especially if you are an admirer of Galileo and Descartes. That's Grayling. Deb's reading Lawrence Krauss's A Universe from Nothing, an examination of the quantum physics explanation of the Big Bang. I have actually read it. What can you recommend to our listeners?
Well, a couple that I've just picked, Einstein's Heroes would probably have been a good one for Deb to have read before she actually attempted the current one. Very interesting look at particularly James Maxwell's contribution to understanding the sort of the gap between electricity and magnetism and where we've moved in quantum mechanics. By a woman called Robin Arian Hodd, who is an Australian. And the other one I was given the other day by Steph, who by a friend of hers called Margaret Wertheim, called Pythagoras's Trousers, which is subtitled God, Physics and the Gender Wars. And she makes a really interesting point, first of all, about the role of women right across that whole period, which are very rarely mentioned, as you pointed out earlier, but also about the link between obviously the church and the monarchy in terms of suppressing women's opportunity and access. By the way, Grayling makes quotes Queen Victoria on her opposition to suffrage. suffragette is a good example of how women can be pushed out of opportunity. But it's certainly an interesting book and good physics in it too, is my impression.
I reckon the best books are the ones about how a body of scientific knowledge that's causing trouble, if you will, interfaces with the society that is surrounding it, as you were sort of talking about with Pythagoras' Trousers then. And like, there's so many things, as we're sort of saying, that are going on now that we're going through the same thing. But as you've said a couple of times on this program, also the treatment of women in science has been appalling if you want to look for a social issue. You can read about any of them. They were kept down, even though they made many of those important scientific discoveries themselves. There was even questions asked about Einstein, I believe.
That's right. And talked to his wife, not to Albert.
Did his wife do the mathematics?
That's the story.
And just to go over your books, Dennis.
Oh, well, there's the one about deadly companions, and a few years since I've read this. It's called Run Like You Stole Something, which is written by two sports scientists to take us off on a totally different sort of tack. And perhaps just a thought out of it, Brian, it says the dominance of West African sprinters. Now, we've just seen a very good one.
Oh, yes.
It says, in all 40 finalists in the Olympic men's 100 metres finals from 1984 to 2000, men of black African descent and women have won them. The mathematical likelihood of this based on the world's population is in the order of 1 to the minus 44, which is very, very small. No white athlete in legal condition has run this distance in under 10 seconds. Black athletes have done it over 200 times. And it's all down to genetics.
Wow.
So you've got it or you haven't. Isn't that sad?
Yeah. Well, for some of us, it's a bit sad.
No matter how much we sort of pour into the OIS, we're never going to get a Usain Bolt unless we can recruit some Africans. West Africans.
Well, that's what the USA have done, haven't they? Yeah.
Well, there's a Kenyan running for England.
Yeah, that's right.
And an interesting point to finish with, perhaps, Arthur Koestler in The Sleepwalkers makes the point that there was about 2,000 years between Pythagoras and Copernicus. And what happened to science for those 2,000 years? It got lost in the dogmatism of Aristotle.
Mm-hmm.
And
only in the West.
Yeah, only in the West, certainly, yes. But I think it's an interesting point that dogmatism can have a very, very bad impact on the thinking of whole cultures.
Hmm.
Well, I think also that sort of notion of a hierarchy of those who have are infallible or have a divine right is also sort of challenges what we're doing. And I mean, Dennis has just raised it again that if we use genetics as our definer, then we actually limit the sense of who we are as a species. So somewhere in there, I think we've obviously got to sort of, and again, the great point about Grayling, somewhere you need to be independent and have your own integrity, and you need to be valued because of who you are, whether you're suffering from autism or whether or not you're the most trained physicist in the planet. We need some sort of sense that we learn from each other, I think.
It's been a great pleasure to present the science version of the book show on Apollo Bay Radio. Lisa Cameron, thank you very much. Dennis Sharples, it's been a pleasure again.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.
I did read that it's all a figment of your imagination. Everything is happening in your head.